This is tape number 9.
June
7th. The 7th, year 2000. Anyway, these are the people you become involved with, particularly when you have more people per square inch living there than on any place on Earth. You can't avoid these people, you know.
What became of the
cabaret? I don't know what became of the cabaret. We just stayed away from the cabaret.
I thought you were running. I thought that was yeah,
we had a guy in there who ran it for Genovese, but Genovese had his own ideas as to how to run it, and so we were out. But it was just like that. We were out. We were told to stay away. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, they felt too that my living in the village wasn't really very safe with Mr. Genovese taking a view of me, you know. And so that was, I would never sort of go down to McDougal Street, which is the heart of this civilization, for the, you know, I'd stay the hell away from there.
And when was this?
This is in 49, 50, 51. Yes, I'm working as a tailor. Yes, I worked at the athletic club teaching boxing in New York. Yes, I worked on this idiot slave making a super potentiometer.
And
organ boxes with Chuck Mongravini.
During these years?
During these years. All concurrent with one another. All these things are going on. So I'm married to a fellow named Bobby Teager, and he remembered one night I was thrown out of my abode, and I had an easel with wheels on it, you see, little wheels, and in the structure of this easel, I had a sleeping bag and all my paint accoutrements, and Bobby says, "What's the matter?" I said, "I'm looking for a place in which to live." And I found a place in which to live. And the funny thing was, harking back to De Niro, who helped on in the Genovese matter, when he got through sobbing and weeping that I would wind up in the East River in a tea bag. I stayed with him. They helped me haul my easel up there, and I worked there. And then I checked the refrigerator, either that I would have to get food or there was food there. There was no food in the refrigerator.
Who were you living with?
Robert De Niro.
Oh, you moved in with him?
Yeah, but then I was out a couple of days later, and I found a place on 15th Street, which is just outside the village. But it was a studio building with Bloom, that wonderful realist painter, Bloom, Peter Bloom.
B-L-U-M?
Yeah. B-L-U-M-E. Yeah. Not sure of his first name, but he was like Ben Sean and the social realist. But he had something else, another dimension to his work.
Were you rooming with him?
No. I was, my roommate there was Elliot Bud Hopkins, he was a student of Hoffman, and then he took over managing the Poindexter Gallery when it was when they ousted Charlie Egan, you know. Then he was put in as the manager. Right. You find in that business, and it is a business. You find people that you have comfort with, you see. My case would be somewhat extreme. This would be like a convict escaping Sing Sing and finding a neighborhood that would accept him, you know what I mean? His persona being complicated by the fact that he might be, you know, a raging sexual serial killer, you see. But I had, you know, these I had attributes here, and I needed a place of shelter, and the village was it. And it was not difficult for me to find or latch onto or be part of a group who were trying something new with an underlay of expatriate painters of the highest, of a high magnitude, who lived in their midst and who would inspire, took them beyond parochialism.
Who are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of Chagall, I'm thinking of Marcel Duchamp. I'm thinking of the two German painters, but I can't think of his name. He went down to Taos, New Mexico. Sculptural work. I don't know why I can't think of his name. And I knew his son, who lived in New York. Anyway, they were a great inspiration to us. And then there was something in the air, we shall do what we like. We will not have people telling us how to put a painting together, you see. And there was an attitude of, you know, to move forward, you must destroy Buddha. Destroy Buddha and, you know, you see. So that was a prevailing attitude. Of course, going back, I made a mistake. It was not Thelonious Monk. It was Miles Davis. Miles Davis. I'm sorry. It was Miles Davis that we all volunteered to clear out that little hole in the wall store. And on his first performance in his own place, with his own band, with his friends who put in there, the son of a bitch turned his back on us. So, you know, people make a statement, let them make the statement, but don't try to disinter it, you know, don't waste time. And that's what Miles Davis did. Then I think he went to Spain, places like that. It was rough on jazz musicians. We had befriended Joe Albany. I think that you find a group who cannot articulate what the hell they were doing. I think the fame of Robert Motherwell was he was able to articulate what he was doing. Give to people, you know, the cause raison of what we were doing, and could articulate this.
Like an interpreter almost.
Yeah. And we looked to poets to interpret what we did. So there was this relationship. So that's how you wind up with a group of people who find one another and who exhibit together, and then finally will break into a gallery, you see. I don't know whether this is something that has changed, you know. I don't believe so. You have to come up with something new. You have to kill Buddha, and you see, you know, this sort of thing being done, you know. Like you want a sensational show that will bring in the people, said this British group of artists, so they come up with the show with that title, you see. Does that answer that question?
What you were doing, you mean, or how you
got what I was doing, how I got into the gallery. I wandered over the original Poindexter Gallery was on 38th Street, across from the Comedy Club Theatre. And I don't know who I went to first, but he was willing, was George Dillon, to look at new paintings. And he made a stand for them, he said, you know. Then Rockefeller became interested in and secretly supported the Expressionists. So he could, and there would always be some eccentric like that. So you'd swarm into that gallery, you know, this is where you would be, and the word would spread like a wildfire. So the guys who painted and having an exhibit didn't assuage their hunger by this. I mean, you can have an exhibit, but the money didn't come rolling in. Showed with Charlie Egan, who was really the greatest he was the one who discovered these people and encouraged them. Charlie Egan. We talk about Poindexter and these other people, but it was really Charlie Egan. Charlie Egan needed, he could see the potential and the stirring, the stir that was being made, you know, these, some measure had to be taken of these people by law enforcement, by the universities, by this or by that, you know. And there was a battle which came a cropper. It didn't work. And Charlie needed money to present these people in a fulsome way, you know, in a conventional way. And Poindexter came along to fund the gallery, which Charlie Egan would run. And alas, it was inevitable that they wouldn't get on. They didn't get along with one another. And Poindexter kicked him out. He kicked him out of that business, from all that he discovered. He had him selling outside of modern art. I ran into him one day accidentally. I was visiting the Castelli Gallery, which used to be on 74th Street. Knocked on the wrong door, and poor Charlie Egan opened it, and I glimpsed around. It was a you know, Vernissage Privé. The private showing was what, he had a little gallery, and there were Rembrandt prints on the wall that he was selling.
And what, you know,
did you say it was, Vernissage? Vernissage Privé means private showing. Mm-hmm. You all run into that. He was a great art dealer, and he loved painters. Painters loved him, and I feel terrible about the role I played, you know. And
what role was that? I don't recall you.
He kited a check, and then as the gallery moved forward under the aegis of George Poindexter, he championed that gallery, and you know, people with resources would come, and then Charlie would turn up drunk and you know, create a situation during openings, you know. So I was given the task of getting him out of the building and into a cab, you know. And sometimes he'd really be obstreperous in, you know, an Irish way, and I'd have to throw him out with, you know, bonus points that I don't want to really talk about. Poindexter had two charming daughters, Joan and Leslie. And George was very interested in stereophonic equipment, which at that time did not exist, except in theories, you know, the way computers were in garages once upon a time. And you'd look at these discombobulated things and just take at their word what these machines could do from geeky-looking 17-year-olds. So we had, Poindexter said, is there anyone here? Do you know of anyone, Alfred, who could set up a stereo system for me? And this was a complicated thing to do. You'd have to buy the speakers one place and all the other equipment. And a long time ago, a stereo set was a conglomeration of wires, you know, that never fit into anyone's environment. But people took a sadistic pride in them. And anyway, the fellow, whose name was Lafleur, who was somewhat of a poet, but deeply interested in electronics, and he vowed that he could fix up George. And he went to, he set up a stereo in George's house, I think he converted the roof into a speaker system. And but George just loved this sort of thing. It drove the daughters away, and his wife away from the house in which they lived. But he came enamored of LaFleur, and finally he gave LaFleur advice on the first of these conglomerates that were bringing forth the beginning of computers. And overnight, young LaFleur made a fortune. And he was in the Caribbean, visiting the island of St. Lucia, where George bought land. And he spoke to the captain, and he said, "What time is it?" And the fellow said, "It's 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock." And Louis jumped overboard and killed himself that way. Apparently, so I was blamed for this disaster, And also he married one of the Poindexter girls, which was also a disaster, and abandoning his own wife and three children in the process, you see. So I became, you can get into a gallery, and these events that have nothing to do with you, you see, you become a persona non grata.
Why were you blamed for that?
Because I brought LaFleur to their home to build a goddamn stereo set. But they're really, this is like harnessing a geek nowadays, This is, but this was the only fellow I knew who could do it. And certainly they enjoyed his ministrations, Of course, in later years, I went down to St. Lucia because it became a regular place where people could prepare for shows in New York at Poindexter Gallery. When I went there, Nell Blaine put a show forth, and a post and a cover for Reader's Digest, I saw her do a cover for Reader's Digest a couple of years ago, and that seemed amazing to me. But I went down there and didn't put a show together and became involved in the politics of the island. And
was this when he hired you to run his place, or was that a later
event? Yes, this was a later event, many years later, when in desperation, when Meyer Shapiro withdrew his sponsorship of me.
So you went there more than once, at least twice?
Yeah.
Okay. And you went to prepare a show, but you didn't prepare one?
No, I didn't.
So you didn't have the show?
No, I didn't have the show. I'm thinking about what happened to me on St. Lucia, I think there was a British painter, I came up with his name, I can't think of it at the moment, who lives there on Christmas Island, and it's really like something out of Robinson Crusoe, very beautiful. But I never got along with the people there, and didn't get along with them at all, and had to leave, you see. But that's me, and these other people went there and did work, so there must be something wrong with me.
Well, more like your natural environment was New York, in the village. Was that? Oh, were you?
Yes, Dan.
Oh.
Okay.
All right, now you're on again, okay? So now,
okay.
You said you and Patty went there about 36 years ago back to the village.
Yeah, we went back to the village and we visited the places where I used to hang out, but
it had changed.
It was it felt very violent, it was not the village where I lived and where I felt so safe. Mm-hmm. And where you had a proximity to people. One day, for instance, one day, I'd just gotten back from Provincetown, and there were two other guys who were students. One was from Colorado, Charles Armstrong Littler. The other fellow was a New York boy, George Capsis. And Chuck went on to become head of the art department, University of Arizona. It was in a province town, which almost isn't really like the real world. He would opine that when he gets to New York, the first thing he wants to do is visit Mark Rothko. And I said, I wouldn't do that if I were you. I said, Rothko hates everyone. He's finished with art, and just stay the hell away from him. Trust me. Anyway, we found an apartment on 57th Street. He found it. You know, here's a guy who's new in the city. And, of course, going out to the country is always a disruption. You lose the place where you were staying, you know, you team up with new people. And this guy found an apartment just like that. Also, one night, we were invited to an opening at the Guggenheim, and Chuck had a car. It's a huge Nash Rambler, you know. It was like an inverted bathtub. And we used to park it next to the Kosciuszko Bridge, which is the bridge that comes into 57th Street in East New York. We all went out. We were going to go to this party, and the car was gone. And Chuck said, my God, they've stolen my car. And I said, Chuck, look at these other vehicles here. You know, there is a Rolls Royce, there are Mercedes, and there are Cadillacs, largely Cadillacs. I said, why would anyone want to steal, you know, this wreck that we drove up to Promised Land now? So in high dudgeon, he went to the police station. And I said, this is a mistake, Chuck. I'd stay away from the cops if I were you. He said, no, I'm going to find out who stole my car. Anyway, so we go to this police station in the precinct, and it's like what you see in the movies. There's a sergeant who's adjudicating justice with two little lights on either, a light on either side of him. And Chuck approached the guy at this podium. He said, someone stole my car. And the fellow said, what's your name? And I said, your car was impounded, son, and there's $800 worth of tickets on it. He said, where are you from? He said, I'm from Steamboat Springs, Colorado. My dad is the judge there, Judge Armstrong, Littler. And he said, really? Steamboat Springs. He thought this was very amusing, but the sergeant anted up a collection to pay for the parking tickets. I mean, 850 years ago was like, it's like, what, $4,000 now? We couldn't afford it. The car wasn't worth that. And they raised the money in the station house with this kid from Steamboat Springs. I couldn't believe it. They would have, If it was me or George Capsis, well, George Capsis would have gotten the boot, you know. So we get our car back, and we went to this opening. I think it was at the Guggenheim, at the old Guggenheim. This is when Jackson Pollock, you know, chose this juncture, this social gathering, to piss in the fireplace, you know, and was given the old heave-ho, which really amused old man Guggenheim. I think I had a little too much to drink at this affair. There was I was there with Bud Hopkins, I recall, and of course my roommates, and I was introduced to old man Guggenheim, and I thought, he's such a little man, little fellow, and I said, why don't we take him home with us? I'll grab him, we'll put him on the mantel shelf. So they threw me out. My own friend said, you can't do that. You don't fuck around like that, dear. You know, you're not Jackson Pollock, you know, that's his garbage. And he was forewarned about Jackson, but you, you'll wind up, let's get out of it. So they took me out. I mean, these things happen to you. We had to see, I want to say that there was something, he was like, he had the sweetness of a saint, did Jackson Pollock. And I observed him painting once for just a few minutes, and I thought, this is, my being here might upset the spirit of his work, and I got to get out. But he seemed to glide. There was a delicacy about him. You wondered if his feet were actually on the ground, you see. And there's this choreography which I witnessed. But one day, he had a wonderful little studio that was near this restaurant in the village on 8th Street, an upper, a wonderful restaurant with a name like Lou Chow's. It's not Lou Chow's on 14th Street. This was another old restaurant. The food was wonderful. We can never afford to eat there. And somehow, nowadays, the carriage trade would arrive in carriages, and they had a horse delivery. And he was ensconced in the stable of this restaurant, was Jackson Pollock. And we weren't used to his modus vivendi, his operation. And we knew that he put paintings down on the floor. We were to see him because he had a foam rubber mattress that he wanted to get rid of, you see, because he wasn't going to sleep in this place. Now he had a wife, and he needed the floor space. He was his easel was the floor. So anyway, Chuck was kind of timorous about things, and I banged on the door, and Jackson said, okay, oh, come on in. I said it's about, I told him it was about the foam rubber mattress. So this stable door opened. It didn't open, you know, it opened out to let the horse out. And the next thing I know, and I used to jump and leap over fences and things and leap into rooms. I see this in my son. And the next thing I know, I've leapt into this room, and I was, my sneakered foot was on a painting. And I had sense enough not to bring down the other foot. And I thought, Jesus Christ, what have I done? You know, I appreciated Jackson then, you see. I thought, this is the masterpiece, and how can I do something like this? But Jackson was very calm. He said, can you jump to where I am? And I said, I can jump forward, yeah. He says, then do that. You're on one foot now. Can you jump back to the door where Chuck is? Chuck can grab you. He'll grab you, I'll grab you over here. I said, I'll jump forward. He said, great. So I jumped, and he grabbed. I made a good jump off of one foot and cleared the canvas. So I have a footprint in a painting by Jackson Pollock that was the length of the room. I mean, these sort of things happen, you see, because of the proximity of everyone and everything. Across the way was a little art store supplying tourists, and the fellow's name was, I think of his name, but he had been in Paris, he visited Paris, and had a wonderful bargain that we appreciated. And it was drawings by Rodin. And in France, when an artist dies, this sounds like a great idea, the government will take artworks, you see. In this country, they don't. In this country, they estimate the fair trade value of the paintings and demand money up front. That isn't really very good. I don't want to go into horror stories. But the bad thing about the French is that they will say that, for instance, difference in the case of Rodin, that the thinker and all that is what is the value of this painter, see. So that doesn't take the tax in sculpture, but the drawings they're not interested in. So they tread all of these things or throw them in waste baskets, see. Particularly if the guy has died and his family, you know, no longer exists. Keck was the name of this fellow, K-E-C-K. So he visited the studios of Rodin, and there are all these drawings over the floor. So he patiently picked them up, you know, 500 of them, brought them home. And you can easily buy them. He'd sell them for $10 or $20 each. God, I didn't do it. Around the same time, Monet died. The tax people came, and they took the paintings that represented, you know, an aesthetic value, not fair trade value, but to the French, the aesthetic value. They took the paintings in legal tax, you see. But the huge paintings, the last ones of his life, they knocked aside. It's difficult knocking aside a painting that goes from that wall to this wall and is 7 foot high. And there's a reason for this. Because in the last days of his life, he said, I want you to become totally engulfed in the painting. There is an observer's position that you must take 7 feet from the painting so that your peripheral vision is taken up with the painting. And you become engulfed in water with this. But these had no aesthetic value to the tax people, and they trod on them, they damaged them. They sheltered lesser works from the rain until the trucks came to take away what they felt was the tax value. And once again, there, some American students that he had that worked with him at Givenchy salvaged these great paintings and brought them to America. So you deal with Philistines in every system, you know. Well, those are interesting stories. The American stories are just horror stories of income tax. The hell with it, you know.
How you thought about your art, how you thought about whether you were in a movement, an art movement of some sort, or were you aware of being in an unusual time in art? Did you have a philosophy about art
and what you thought it should be, what you wanted your art to be? I think, whether you like it or not, you you know, as disparate as the different concepts can be, you wind up in a movement because there's a uniform hostility to the newness of the thing. I think of Joseph Cornell, who was part of this movement, but very much a loner and eccentric. He reminds me when I saw the movie The Bates Hotel with Perkins, the psychopathic guy. He came out of some old house with the family in nearby New Jersey and would journey into Manhattan, you see. And he looked like someone who would molest children, and apparently his life ended on that note. He was in love with some 13-year-old, and teenagers were robbing him of his boxes. But yes, he was in the movement. And I could go on endlessly about people who were in the movement, but there were people who couldn't transcend this influence and emerge, you see, with their own thing, you see.
Motherwell, I believe it was him, said that he thought Pollock was almost captured by Picasso for some long period of time. That it was hard, Pollock and somebody else, hard for them to kind of break loose from that influence. Is that what you're talking about?
I think that Pollock's great influence was the paintings of Hart Benton. You know, he impending storm, and you know, people as colossi, you know, wielding tractors and stuff like that, you know. But there's a compositional impact to the paintings of Hart Benton, you know. His composition was very powerful and overwhelming. That is, you can enjoy, you can turn the painting over and dispense with, you know, what I've mentioned and still observe how, you know, greatness in composition, his dynamic. And Pollica studied with him, you see. But then you see, in many of his compositions, you see the influence of Hart Benton, you see. That there has to be a new kind of space, you know.
That's what you mean by transcend the movement, is that?
Yeah, he transcended that master with something that is uniquely his own, you see. There are other people who never transcended this. And there are people who went kind of crazy in trying to find themselves and kill themselves. You had people who, you know, one remembers the things of...
Gorky?
No, not Gorky, but Gorky was an enormous influence on William de Kooning. And William de Kooning's life, this business with women, he was brought up by a mother who used to kick the shit out of him, you know, and and sometimes he'd talk about that. He'd talk about that to me, but to nobody else. I don't think he was ever sure who his father was, you know. My philosophy is something I had to do, whether I liked it or not, you see. And I resented really having to do this, you see. It's something I had to do.
You simply had to do it.
I simply had to do it, you know. And as luck would have it, I could do something that, you know, people could enjoy. And I love that, you know. So, you know, is that the philosophy, you know, it's like the nasty, like the psychopath who has to do what he has to do, but, you know, I had to do it. And, you know, I understood the upwelling of success in the movement, and when those boys took me over to Janice, you see, I knew something that they didn't know. That they were now embarking on a gravy wagon.
Uh-huh.
On a gravy wagon, a gravy train,
okay.
That would give them millions of dollars, you see. Of course, within a year of his, a couple of years of making money for the first time in his life, Klein got killed, you know. The same was true with how Pollock handled his success. He got killed. And de Kooning, the only thing that saved his life was that he's dysfunctional. He wound up with Alzheimer's, but I've always recognized him as a person with that kind of mental dysfunction. See. But once again, a kind of a magical creature was de Kooning too, you know. A discussion with de Kooning, particularly if it was confronted by young people, would be the nearest I can. The way to describe this encounter would be the Cats and Jammer Kids, and he would sound like the captain in that cartoon, with this Dutch accent, And all these little painters, like the little Katzenjammer kids, you see. And sometimes he would say, what am I going to talk about tonight when I meet these people, when I meet these people? Why do we have to talk and defend ourselves? I said, the best thing you can do is study Kierkegaard. Just remember one line and take it to a cocktail party or what have you, and the people will slide off your back, you know. And you have an accent, and it makes everything excusable. But remember Kierkegaard, and you'll be on your way. The only thing that's ever going to bother you will be taken care of by Kierkegaard. And he started reading Kierkegaard, and he thought, this is fascinating. Then, typical of the village was living in a little building that was three stories high. This guy, Philo T. Farnsworth, with this atom bomb. And my idea was not to go back to the building, because what if that bomb blows up? And I'll be safe living on 15th Street, you see? What kind of brain did I have? But then I met a young lady that people would call UC. And I thought, this is a plain girl. And really, very nice, and she's honest. Meanwhile, I was being pursued by another girl, and she had this big black vehicle. It was a Plymouth, and I thought, she is dreadfully rich from Philadelphia, and a good painter, too. Phyllis Jampolsky was the name. She wound up organizing action scenes and happenings for the city of New York. New York, she had this job organizing these affairs at Central Park. But I thought of her, she's very rich because she has a big car. And UC was poor and plain, and she had a little car, you see. And I like her. And UC stood for Union Carbide, which her daddy owned, a huge Porsche. And the little car was a Porsche. So what you have in my case is untraveled ignorance, you know, I'm embarrassed at how I carried on. And yet there was Chuck, who charmed everybody. Chuck, going back to Nickerson Lane, that little street and the barn where we studied with Hoffman, there was the widow Nickerson. That was her name. And the widow Nickerson would not allow any students in her place. And every year, without fail, students would knock on the widow's door. And during this period of a few weeks, that time slot when they were looking for places to stay, she would position herself in a rocking chair on her porch in this clapboard house with corn cobs drying. And she would station herself there, and you would walk into the house. I did once upon a time, and so did George Capsis. And she said, no, boys, I'm not having anyone in that shed yonder. And we'd leave, and everyone would try this. But Chuck Littler walked in there. I said, forget about that. She won't let us in. She's never done this. And she said, oh, yes, you can stay there. Yes. And so we all moved into the barn. We thought, well, the widow Nickerson doesn't have to know that we're all sneaking over the back fence. But how do you explain his total naivete with the New York police, the widow Nickerson, who opened her heart? And then we wondered if there was anything she needed from the shack. She said no. And there was a trunk in there, and we opened it. And we looked at it. And it seemed that her lover, the guy she was engaged to, there were pictures of her with this young man, a sailor, a fisherman, and he died at sea, you see. Is she a widow if her fiancé dies, you know? But that was the mystery of the widow Nickerson, and of course we stayed there that year and the year after. And she knew that we were all staying there, and it was cost us $5 a month or something like that, you know.
Okay.